Come down, open up your eyes, make me look inside. If you want to overstand this, open up wide. Open up your house, make the refugee come in. You might overstand and start helping. Open your imagination or go for a ride. If you want to overstand this, open up wide. Open up your house, make the refugee come in. You might overstand and start helping. Open your imagination or go for a ride. If you want to overstand this, open wide. Open up your fist and welcome a kiss. Get a load of this, open up business. Open up your bank account and spend. Open up your wallet and check a friend. Open up the dance floor, make I dance. Open up your body and love romance. If you have not opened up, you have not tried. If you want to overstand this, open wide. Open up the border, free up the land. Open up the books in the Vatican. Open up yourself to any possibility. Open up your heart and your mentality. Open any door that you confront. Let me put it straight, sincere and blunt. Narrow-mindedness must run and hide. If you want to overstand this, open wide.
Wow. How does arts open up politics?
Well, you know, I used to think, and you have a lot of people that used to think, and some people still think, that, you know, music and poetry is going to change the world, and we're going to have this worldwide revolution. I don't think it's going to work like that. What can happen is that we can influence individuals, and a lot of those individuals go on to have places of influence. And I know that. I've seen that happen with my poetry. I remember performing in Dublin, doing a talk about education and how important poetry is and creativity in education, and giving young people, giving them the ability to speak and teaching them self-confidence. You know, and a few years later, I was in South Africa, and this guy came up to me and he said, I remember that speech you did in Dublin about education, etc., etc., and it really had an effect on me. I said, what did you do with it? And he said, well, I'm Minister of Education now. And it's something that's kind of intrinsic in my education policy. So, you know, from that little pub in Dublin to a free South Africa. And I've known it happen in other ways as well.
We're visiting London, where you had millions of people in the streets opposing the war in Iraq, and yet your country went to war with the majority, the vast majority of people against it. Yes. So how do people's voices make a difference?
This is very difficult. I mean, I do think we still have to come out on the street. I do think that we still have to stand up and be counted. But it seems that in this age of technology, when everybody says we're connected, and, you know, people feel that they're playing a part in the democratic process because they send an email to their MP or they vote, it seems that we have less and less of a voice. It's really crazy that we have more of the hardware, but no one seems to be listening. I got to tell you, deep down, and it's almost sound like a politically incorrect thing to say nowadays, but deep down, I'm a revolutionary. Deep down, I think we've got to start again. I think money is too important in this system. I think party politics is too important, and I think the show business of politics is important. It's about personalities. I saw Tony Benn earlier. He's my mentor, you know, and one of the things he taught me is that it's not about personalities. You know, you really have to look at the policies of these people and what they stand for and the whole system. And I think the system stinks, and I think we have to start again.
Can you share one more poem?
Could I share another poem? This usually costs money, you know. But it's not about the money. Another poem. This poetry is like a rhythm that drops. The tongue brings a rhythm that shoots like a shot. This poetry is designed for ranting, dancehall style, big mouth chanting. This poetry won't put you to sleep saying, follow me like your blind sheep. This poetry is not party political, not designed for those who are critical. This poetry goes with me when I go to my bed. It gets into my dreadlocks and it lingers around my head. This poetry is with me when I'm riding my bike. I have tried Shakespeare, respect Judea, but this is the stuff I like. This poetry is not afraid of going in a book, no, but this poetry needs ears to hear and eyes to have a look. Yes, this poetry is verbal rhythm, no big words involved. And if I have a problem, the rhythm gets it solved. I have tried to be romantic, it did no good for me. Take a reggae rhythm and build my poetry. I could try something personal, but you've heard it all before. No written words are needed because plenty words in store. This poetry is called dub ranting. The tongue plays a beat and the body starts skanking. This poetry is quick and childish. This poetry is for the wise and foolish. Anybody can do it for free. This poetry is for you and me. Don't stretch your imagination. This poetry is for the good of the nation. Chant. In the morning, morning, I chant. In the night, I chant in the darkness and under the spotlight. I passed through university, I passed through sociology, and then I got a dread degree in dreadful ghetto ology. This poetry is with me when I take a walk, and when I am talking to myself in poetry, I talk. This poetry is with me, below me and above. You see, this poetry is from inside me, and go see you with love.
British Rasta poet Benjamin Zephaniah. That does it for our broadcast from New York. We'll be broadcasting from, we broadcast from London today, New York tomorrow. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, welcome to Terra Informa, environmental issues around us. I'm your host of this week, Sana. This week, Marcus interviewed with Sheila Watt-Cloutier, Rebecca will define the word biodiversity with EcoBubble, and Brett will talk about solar energy. But first of all, Andy tells the past week's news.
On September 16th, the Alberta Energy Resources Conservation Board issued its decision on the Total application for a 300,000 barrel per day oil sands upgrader in the Strathcona County. The ERCB, in its 62-page decision report, has conditionally approved the application for the upgrader, despite Alberta Environment's cumulative effects framework, which seems to have little teeth in managing the air and watersheds in the Industrial Heartland area. The conditions placed on the approval include achieving a sulfur recovery rate of 99.5% within 6 months of project commencement, conducting a full-scale emergency response exercise prior to project startup, submitting an emergency response plan, conducting a number of sound monitoring plans and surveys, and ensure that the construction of the upgrader begins by 2016. The decision report also included a number of recommendations to Alberta Environment around monitoring plans and data gathering, allowing the ERCB to wipe their hands clean of those responsibilities. This highlights the disconnection between the ERCB and Alberta Environment in their approval processes. The decision comes in the face of significant resistance from local landowners, who believe that the approval should incorporate the community standards for downstream and emergency evacuation procedures, and not just consider the ERCBs. The members of Citizens for Responsible Development live within 20 kilometers of the proposed site, and opposed the project at the public hearing held in June of this year, with concerns over health impacts, air pollution, risk to water supply, light and noise pollution, and land use. A new report from Statistics Canada has reported on the freshwater supply and demand of Canada, with some troubling results. It shows that Canada's renewable freshwater supply has dropped dramatically over the last 3 decades in the heavier populated areas of the country. The report indicated that since 1971, the water yield in southern Canada has decreased by 8.5%. The annual absolute decrease in water supply is equivalent to the volume supplied to residential customers each year. The prairies in particular were impacted significantly, which showed to have the lowest water yield and highest variability in water yield. The report also indicated that 90% of withdrawn water volumes were used to support industrial and commercial activities. Most of these volumes were consumed by the thermal electric power generation industry. Only 9% of withdrawn volumes were used by the residential sector, and 56% of that volume was supplied by utility water systems. The report might be hard to stomach during the current period of high precipitation in Alberta. However, it is clear that this indicates an increasing issue of water supply for Canada on a whole. According to the Calgary Herald, John Pomeroy, director of the Center for Hydrology at the University of Saskatchewan, indicate that it is clearly climate warming. As Canada warms, evaporation generally increases due to shorter winters, Pomeroy said in an email. He went on to say that across the prairie provinces, groundwater and pond levels have dropped for most of the last 25 years, and the Great Lakes have seen more ice-free periods and longer evaporation periods. According to the Edmonton Journal, Suncor is facing environmental charges for the third time in just over 2 years. The oil sands company faces 9 charges because it allegedly failed to comply with its Water Act license and approval and for providing misleading information to Alberta Environment about stormwater runoff at its Voyager upgrader site. In 2008, the company also faced a charge for failing to provide information to Alberta Environment about a contravention. Cindy Chasian, executive director of the Environmental Law Center, said it's not surprising that Alberta Environment would aggressively pursue charges against a company that failed to provide it with information, which is a cornerstone of the compliance system. Chasian said Alberta Environment's track record shows that when multiple charges are laid, they will ensure that if there is a plea bargain, that there are guilty pleas on the company's failure to report. Suncor has said that in both cases, there were fairly complex regulatory processes in play. Spokesman Brad Bellows said they believed they were in compliance with the regulation at the time, therefore they did not provide the regulatory with a report saying that they were not in compliance. Suncor's first court appearance on the current charges is set for November 3rd in Fort McMurray.
Thanks, Andy. If you are just tuning in, this is Terra Informa, a weekly environmental news program. From our website, terrainforma.ca, you can find all additional information that you want. Chilawat Cloutier is a Canadian activist, teacher, and advocate for Indigenous rights. In 2007, she was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize for her work drawing attention to the human rights impacts of climate change. With a focus on solutions, Chilawat Cloutier brings us to the realities of the Arctic, where Inuit today face profound challenges to their environment, their economy, their health, and their cultural well-being. The challenges they face are clearly connected to the industries we support, the disposable world we have become, and the non-sustaining policies we create. Because our Inuit culture faces the most extreme challenges of globalization, Wat Cloutier speaks from first-hand experience and couples that with her extensive experiences as a global leader. Drawing up on her ancient culture and speaking from a position of strength, not victimhood, she helps audiences find common ground. Terra Informa correspondent Marcus Peterson gives us exclusive interview with Wat Cloutier.
Do you see the globalization of the North and the assimilation of the people of the North as inevitable?
No, I don't. I mean, I think if I thought that that was the case, I wouldn't be still plugging away like I do over the last 15 years. I don't think it's assimilation that is the answer to anything. I have had this question asked of me with a young, I think he was a young university student in the United States, and he said to me, "Why don't you folks just all assimilate and become engineers?" He said, I think he used the term engineers. And I said, you know, it isn't about either or. I'm not asking my grandson that he just remains a hunter on the land. He can be whatever he wants to be. Wants to be a hockey player, then let him be a hunting hockey player. When I say these things about being connected to the land, it's about being aware of what is happening to the land and the cycles of nature. If you connect to that, then you will not be there trying to make it worse. You will understand and appreciate how Mother Earth and the cycles of nature work, and how ecosystems work, and wildlife work, and human beings who live on the, you know, on the well-being of the environment and climate. So it isn't about, you know, giving up one way of life to go into another. That isn't about that. It's about the balance of both worlds. In fact, the young people who are making it in the Arctic are the ones who have a foot in both worlds. So, you know, my grandson may go hunting with his father for a weekend. The next weekend, he's in his hockey tournament. Do you know what I mean? So that these things are about balancing that. And so, but if you just take away the hunter-gatherers of the world, then it's a huge loss to the world, because the hunter-gatherers are the ones that are on a daily basis witnessing what's happening to our planet, because they rely upon it. There's an intimate knowledge and relationship with it. And they become then the sentinels that signal what's happening to the rest of the planet. When you live in an urban setting like Edmonton, for example, you would never know there was anything wrong with the planet, except maybe you have some freak weather patterns coming in and out. But if you rely upon the safety of snow, the safety of ice, the safety of the winds and patterns and all of that as a hunting-gatherer peoples, then you know you witness the most minute changes on a daily basis. You know you depend upon it for safety and security. As I said earlier, if your road started to buckle, boy, there'd be an outcry saying there's something terribly wrong going here. All the roads in Canada are buckling. Well, the ice is melting. The roads are buckling because of permafrost. The runways are buckling because of permafrost. All of those things are happening up there. And so that's why I'm saying is that our highways are in danger, and it doesn't allow us to be safe as much as we wanted to be or have been for millennia, for people who have thrived, not only survived, but thrived in what we have. So I think, you know, again, it's just to look at the Arctic as a people who love their way of life, whose way of life is very powerful in terms of the connection to sustainability, the connection to nature, and so on. And it's that disconnect that I talk about more than anything, where I say, isn't it because we've become so disconnected to our environment, to each other, that we are debating this issue of climate change in the first place? So I'm saying, by looking at the Arctic Inuit story, let's try to reconnect. And that's what this is all about.
Where do you believe the greatest barriers to real, meaningful change are coming from?
I think the biggest barriers are not from citizens of the world who really want to do the right thing. I think it's the barriers lie with our government policies. Leaders get elected, and then they posture to keep their positions. They're working so hard at holding on to their jobs that they're not doing their jobs. And so it becomes an issue where leaders don't take the bold, courageous steps it takes to do the right thing. Instead, they're worried about the next election and not winning it if they do the wrong thing. And so I think our own institutions are the trouble, and our government institutions definitely are the ones that we're most challenged with. Because, you know, I think economists and I think are starting to get on side more than we know. They're understanding these issues a lot more than we are. So there's countries in the world that are switching to other green technology. They are lowering their emissions, and they're not necessarily, destroying their economies or their industries. And we should be modeling ourselves after some of those countries that are making this work. Instead, we're just so paralyzed by the fear that something is going to go wrong with the jobs and the economy of our countries, and not taking the good risks that it requires. Risks have to be taken if you're in a leadership role, and if you lose the election, so be it. You have to be willing to do that when you go into political office as well, if you are standing on principle, if you're standing on values.
Given that, do you see protocols like the Copenhagen Accord are the most effective means of creating change or mitigating the repercussions of climate change, or is it through the courts or through federal policies or changing public opinion?
It could be all the above. I think it needs to be all of the above. I think the United Nations framework on climate change, the UN process, brings all of these countries together, close to 200 countries, if not more, together, to deal with these issues. And so it is a body that brings people together to work on these globally. So we need that process, you know. Some people have said, oh, maybe it's become obsolete because maybe it's better to work at it, you know, within nations and so on. But I think still we need to work on it at that level. We need to work on it on the nation level. We need to work it at the community, municipality, city levels, at all of those levels, family. Families and communities have been changing for quite some time now in terms of trying to be more eco-friendly with, you know, the bags and the way that they use energy in their homes, and all of these things are really important. But the big scale changes have to come at the policy and industry level, right? And so we need to continue to make sure that all those issues at hand are being dealt with at all of those levels. It has to happen at all the levels.
Thank you very much.
If you want to learn more about Sheila Watt-Cloutier or hear her entire recent speech entitled Everything is Connected, Environment, Economy, Foreign Policy, Sustainability, Human Rights, and Leadership in the 21st Century, go to our website, terrainforma.ca, and search under Bonus Features and Content.
For Terra Informa, I'm Marcus Peterson.
Thanks, Marcus. If you have questions or comments about anything you hear in Terra Informa, look us up on Facebook or send us an email at terra@cjsr.com. Biodiversity is a term we hear a lot, but there's more to it than simply the number of species in a particular area. To explain just what the word means, here's Rebecca with this week's EcoBubble.
Diversity.
Automated metering infrastructure.
Natural energies.
Regulate CO2.
PM control strategies.
Natural resource exploitation.
Steady state.
The United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change.
Uranium.
The Enhanced Oil Recovery.
Sustainable energy.
EcoBabble.
Biodiversity is frequently used as a measure of ecological health, and you often hear environmentalists lamenting the decline in global biodiversity resulting from the extinction of species. Researchers now believe that the current rate of species extinction is 2 to 3 orders of magnitude, that's 100 to 1,000 times higher, than it was before humans hit the scene. Popular science writers like Richard Leakey are calling it a human-induced mass extinction. In fact, in order to raise awareness about the importance of biodiversity and to encourage political leaders to make protecting biodiversity a priority, 2010 has been designated by the United Nations General Assembly as the International Year of Biodiversity. The term biodiversity is a contraction of biological diversity. It was first coined by W.G. Rosen in a speech he gave at the 1986 National Forum on Biological Diversity, hosted by the National Research Council in the USA. But what does it mean? Biodiversity is the sort of term you think you understand, but you might have trouble defining. Because it applies at multiple scales, you might hear it in reference to genetics, to population ecology, community ecology, even landscape ecology. And this doesn't help pin down its meaning. Part of the confusion about biodiversity is that it is comprised of two elements. First, there is the issue of richness. Richness is the number of species or functional groups or plant communities or habitat types or whatever that are present in your spatial scale of interest. A diverse community should have a lot of different species. A diverse landscape should have a lot of different habitat types, etc. Usually, when people say extinction has led to a decline in biodiversity, they're talking about richness. But the second, often overlooked part of the equation is evenness. Think about it. If you had an ecosystem with 100 plant species, you'd think it's pretty diverse. But what if 95% of the individual plants in that habitat all belong to the same species, say purple loosestrife or canola? And the remaining 99 species all add up to only 5% of the total number of individuals. This would be a very uneven distribution, and it would have much lower diversity than an ecosystem that had 100 plant species, each making up an equal proportion of the total plant community. This element of biodiversity can be reduced even without a species going extinct. A major factor driving the global decline in evenness is the human alteration of land, particularly for agriculture and forestry, where monocultures are cultivated. In a 1997 study, Vitasek and his colleagues published a paper showing that between 39 and 50% of the Earth's land surface has been altered by humans, and the number has likely continued to rise since then. Another important problem affecting evenness is the spread of invasive species that become dominant in the ecosystems they invade. Pretty much everyone, Bjorn Lomborg aside, agrees that biodiversity is in decline. But it's not in decline equally around the world. Certain biodiversity hotspots, regions with particularly high richness or evenness, like coral reefs, rainforests, or mangrove swamps, are being affected more than less naturally diverse ecoregions like the tundra. We can make a bigger contribution to maintaining global biodiversity by focusing on protecting these hotspots. But why should we protect biodiversity? There are numerous ecological, economic, and even evolutionary reasons that we should preserve biodiversity. Diverse communities are more resilient to disturbances, they are more capable of adaptation to environmental change, and they may even be more productive than less diverse ones. We are largely unfamiliar with most of the species on Earth, let alone with their complex interdependencies, yet we continue to drive them to extinction. In so doing, we jeopardize the sustainability of our food supply, the quality of our air and water, and the very means of our own survival. And even the sustainability of life on Earth in the broadest sense, as we deplete the raw material on which evolution can act. In light of all of this, it becomes pretty obvious that those UN delegates are right. Conserving biodiversity does need to become a priority. Let's hope the International Year of Biodiversity can help elevate biodiversity on the global political agenda.
Thanks, Rebecca. If you have comments about the show, just drop us a line at 780-492-2577, extension 236, or send us an email at terra@cjsr.com. The most important supplier of energy for Earth is the sun. The whole of life depends on the sun's energy. It is the starting point for the chemical and biological processes on our planet. At the same time, solar radiation is the most environmentally friendly form of all energies. All life on Earth already adapted to its abundance, and it can be used in many ways that we have not yet begun to explore. This week, Brett Taggart looks at solar thermal forms of power generation and how they can change the way we look at electricity both on Earth and in orbit.
It used to be that the term solar panel implied a solar thermal panel, which uses sunlight to heat your house or tap water, as opposed to a photovoltaic panel or solar cell, which produces electric power. These days, though, attention focuses on photovoltaic. It is portable and produces easily usable electricity, which allows for flashy projects like solar cell-covered cars and rooftop power cells for your home. However, anyone who has ever priced out a solar refit to their house or car knows that solar cells are very expensive, and they don't produce a lot of power. Photovoltaic is a new technology, and technological advancement will be needed before mass adoption becomes possible. Re-enter solar thermal. Using the sun to heat an object is a lesson we all performed in grade school. Remember experiments about a magnifying glass and heating up paper till it burned? The greenhouse effect, which most of us learned about in school, is the process of the Earth being warmed by the heat of the sun, which is trapped by our insulating atmosphere. Solar thermal is using that exact principle to heat water, warm your home, and generate electricity for your everyday needs. Many people assume that solar hot water heaters are all well and good for desert climates, but ill-suited to high-latitude, cloudy, snowy climes such as Alberta. That's true for systems that use water. Water cannot absorb that much energy, meaning that the heat stored in water-based systems quickly runs out after the sun goes down. Most new solar thermal systems designed for home heating use use a pressurized glycol water mixture that helps increase the ability of the solution to retain heat for several hours after the sun sets. This arrangement can heat water for household use via a heat exchanger, and can warm the air in your house using a standard radiator arrangement. The only real adjustment one needs to make for a climate such as Alberta's is to increase the solar collector area to accommodate for the shorter days. And unlike the photovoltaic systems, shade on the collectors did not completely destroy performance. As the collector tubes absorb ambient heat, lack of direct sun due to shade from a tree, for example, will mildly reduce efficiency, and after the leaves fall, the collector will operate at full power. Commercial power generation using the heat of the sun operates on the same principle as smaller water heaters. Solar power towers, as they are commonly known, are large commercial plants designed to focus sunlight onto a central point. At this point is a large tower built of insulating material, at the core of which is a body of liquid designed as a convection cell. Just as coal or oil or nuclear plants are designed to heat water and send it through turbines to generate electricity, a solar power tower is designed to heat water, or more commonly a mixture of liquid salt, and send it through a turbine to generate electricity in the same fashion. Using the mirrors to heat the salt mixture has several advantages and disadvantages. The mirrors effectively heat the salt for free. They capture sunlight and redirect it to strike the tower. Through this method, the tower absorbs much more sunlight than it otherwise would and can be heated to enormous temperatures. The salt mixture performs the same task as the glycol water mixture that is used in domestic hot water heating. It has a high tolerance for heat, allowing it to both absorb more heat and hold it for longer than water. Using sodium means that a solar power tower can continue to generate electricity for hours after sundown. Given a large enough plant, it could generate power all night long until the sun rises again. A solar thermal plant looks very similar to a photovoltaic or solar cell plant. Rows of concentric mirrors mounted on rotating bases allow the mirrors to track the sun and focus it on the solar power tower, much like solar panels in a photovoltaic plant. However, the mirrors are significantly cheaper than photovoltaic panels, and the core power tower operates on already developed technology refined in fossil fuel and nuclear plants. The main hurdles to solar thermal plants are inherited problems. Coal, oil, and especially nuclear plants have long been criticized by the potential toxicity and environmental damage produced by the coolant used in the plant, most commonly plain water pumped from nearby streams. When returned to the environment, the heated water, sometimes tainted with heavy metals, can cause deadly damage to the waterways the coolant was drawn from. Solar power towers compound this problem by often being located in desert areas with high temperatures and little surface water. Self-contained coolant systems are very expensive, as evidenced by the high cost of nuclear plants, and could be prohibitive to the construction of new solar thermal plants. On the other hand, pumping water from an underground reservoir or from faraway rivers is expensive and a problem of its own. But for the moment, there exists no possibility of solar power towers inflicting any more than hot water on their environment. Once constructed, the plant will produce no emissions and use no fuel. Efficiency-wise, solar power towers are leaps and bounds ahead of photovoltaic, in both total amount of electricity generated per plant and in efficiency of solar energy to produce electricity.